This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. It used to be that fat was fat and fat was bad. Then we learned about different kinds of fats, some worse for us than others, and then some, like the omega-3 fatty acids, actually good for us. Omega-3 fatty acids are considered essential because our bodies can't make them. They're found primarily in seafood, and they're thought to play a major role in heart health and brain development. That has led to billions of tons of seafood being ground up and boiled down to make supplements. But are they actually saving our lives, and is it worth emptying the oceans for them? These are just a couple of the questions that award-winning author Paul Greenberg tackles in his new book, The Omega Principle: Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Heather.
Let's start with that title. What is the Omega Principle? Is it just eat more omega-3 fatty acids?
Well, it sounds good. No. You know, the Omega Principle is really a principle of how we could eat in a way that would make a diet that would be high in omega-3s, but in a way that would also balance out human food needs with the larger ecological needs of the planet. And, you know, hopefully we'll get to some of this in the conversation. It did take a whole book and several years of research to lay out my argument. So let's try to do what we can in the context of a short interview.
We'll short circuit some of that and let's see if we can get to the punchline, which is,
yep.
Is that even possible? I mean, it sounds like having your cake and eat it too, for everybody to have a seafood-rich diet without emptying the ocean.
I think it is possible, but we need to reorganize the way that we're getting food from the ocean and also the way that we're getting food from the land. To begin with, as you probably know at this point, it used to be 100 years ago, almost everything we ate from the ocean was wild. And now we're just crossing the point where more than half is coming to us from farms. A key component to growing seafood has been the food that we need to feed that seafood in order so that we can eat it. And, surprise, surprise, the thing that goes into growing these fish a lot of times is other fish. It's the same little fish. There are a whole order of fish called clupeids, and things like herring, things like menhaden, sardines, anchovies. These are all fish super high in omega-3 fatty acids, and we could eat them directly, and in fact, it would be very efficient for us to eat them, and we would probably cause less damage to the ocean if we ate them directly rather than grinding them up and turning them into feed for aquaculture and into dietary supplements. But up until now, we've kind of created this industrial animal feed market and human feed market that doesn't make the most efficient use of those really important creatures.
But those are not actually the creatures who make the omega-3s that we want to eat, right? So why is that where you're recommending we eat in order to get omega-3s?
If you really want to go to the source of where omega-3s are primarily made, they mostly come from phytoplankton, that is marine microalgae. And those little tiny creatures invented the omega-3 hundreds of millions of years ago, actually as a defense against climate change, but in that case, as a defense against the cooling ocean. Omega-3s make cell membranes very dynamic, very supple, and very able to function in colder climates. And so that's what microalgae did. They invented this compound that allowed them to live at higher latitudes. You're quite right when you say that these fish don't make omega-3s. Things like anchovies and herring and so forth, they eat the plankton that has synthesized these omega-3s. Actually, to tell you the truth, there's another layer. They eat the zooplankton, which has eaten the phytoplankton, but we won't go down that rabbit hole too far.
The woman who swallowed the spider who swallowed the...
yeah, exactly. It's, you know, it's ecology. But suffice it to say, we get them by eating fish, which in turn got them from eating the algae, more or less. So we could conceivably get omega-3s from algae, and they're in the course of writing the Omega Principle, I actually did visit an algae farm in Texas where they're growing microalgae and synthesizing both protein as well as omega-3s for dietary supplements. So there are all these different workarounds out there that are just sort of rough drafts right now. But in this situation where we're heading towards a planet of 9 billion people, where we have all of these different dietary needs, I think it's really important to not just try and supplement ourselves out of a sort of dietary crisis, but rather to rethink our entire food system in a way that will be more nutritious for us and actually will bring the planet into balance.
I'm talking with author Paul Greenberg about his new book, The Omega Principle: Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. You've mentioned a few times supplements, and that's one major market and one major way that a lot of people who are concerned about getting enough omega-3s do that. And how are those supplements actually made? I mean, you've seen this process now.
I have indeed. Yeah, well, so I went to Peru a few years ago for research for this book, and Peru is actually the source of probably the most fish oil in the world. There's a single fish called the Peruvian anchoveta. It's basically an anchovy. You could have it on a pizza just as well as you could have any other anchovy on your pizza. But in Peru, for whatever reason, well, actually, I go into it in the book, but 99% of those fish are the target of for the reduction industry. And it's important to note that it's not necessarily the omega-3 supplement industry that is targeting these fish. There has been a reduction industry all around the world for a couple hundred years now. And what they do is they reduce all of these little fish into, formerly they were used for fertilizer, then they were used for animal feed, then they were used for aquaculture feed, and the most recent product are these omega-3 supplements. How they're made, it's basically they catch these fish, millions of pounds of fish, go into a cooker, get dehydrated, and turned into sort of a dust that's often called fish flour, that goes into aquaculture meal. And then the oil is separated out and distilled, and that can either also go into fish meal and also pet food and other forms of animal husbandry product, or they get specifically worked on by chemists to be turned into dietary supplements. It's also important to note that the Peruvian anchoveta is this, some years it's been as much as 10% of all the fish caught in the entire world. So like in the 70s when they were really hitting those stocks hard, you could have 10, 15 million tons, metric tons caught every year of Peruvian anchoveta, and we only catch 80 million tons total of all fish in the world. So it's a major, major component. And then if you add up all of the little fish that we reduce, that we turn into these industrial products, you're talking 20, 25 million metric tons. So nearly a quarter of what we catch is ground up into these, into fish flour and fish oil. I guess one of the arguments of the book is, you know, each of these fisheries that I've interviewed for this book, you know, they all say that what they're doing is sustainable and everything's fine. But when you look at the total amount, 20 to 25 million metric tons of little fish being taken out of the sea, you start to wonder, well, what would happen if a quarter of what we catch stayed in the ocean rather than got turned into, you know, animal feed and dietary supplements?
My guest is Paul Greenberg. He's author of The Omega Principle: Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. You said something a couple of minutes ago that grabbed my attention, and that is, quote, some physicians believe. How sure are we that these omega-3s are important enough to warrant, you know, taking billions of tons of seafood out of the ocean or figuring out how to, you know, generate more seafood or more omega-3s through some genetic modification and chemical process? Do we actually need to go to all this effort for omega-3s?
Right. Well, first of all, it's millions of tons, billions of pounds.
Oh, sorry, yes.
I don't want to get anyone in a twist about that. In the 80s, early 90s, when omega-3s really started to ramp up, there were, in fact, some pretty convincing studies that seemed to show a reduction of cardiovascular risk of events if you took omega-3s.
So fewer heart attacks.
For heart attack, for stroke events, as we like to euphemistically call them. But these latest spate of studies have shown very little effect. Some have said no effect at all. So I try to pick apart these studies and try to understand what was going on there. I would say right now on the table, the cardiovascular argument is pretty inconclusive. The larger question around brain health, though, I mean, it is irrefutable that 5 to 10% of the human brain is actually DHA, omega-3 fatty acid. So our brains are made of this stuff. Pregnant mothers can actually synthesize omega-3s through breast milk, and that's probably where we get the initial shot of it as infants. The big question going forward is, do we need to keep supplementing that to kind of help our brains keep from shrinking when we get older? It's an open question, but a question that I think is worth further study.
After having done all of the research, the deep dive into Omega World for this book, plus all of the research that you've done for your previous books on fishing and consuming fish, I mean, you've always kind of played out this struggle and almost contradiction within yourself and within your writing between loving fishing and loving to eat fish, but also loving the ocean and wanting to conserve and preserve ocean resources. In the end, what do you get to in terms of a prescription, if you will, for a diet? What does it look like? What should it look like?
So the billion-dollar diet idea I have that came out of this, I did come up with a diet, and it was informed partly by the omega question, but it was also informed by the research I did into the Mediterranean diet. There's a whole chapter that takes place in Italy, and the Mediterranean diet basically tells us eat a large amount of vegetables, very little animal protein, and you'll end up with probably about the best diet as you can get. My version of it is to make that small amount of animal protein be leaning more towards the sea. So I call this diet the pescaterranean diet. So in other words, what you do is you'd be mostly vegetarian, but a couple times a week you'd have a portion of pretty low impact seafood, so things like anchovies, sardines, one day, and then another day you might have farmed bivalves like mussels and clams and oysters. And that would be it for your animal protein. I mean, that's a hard diet to stick to, and I certainly wouldn't tell people don't eat a well-managed fish like, for example, sockeye salmon from Alaska. That would be a great addition. But I'm saying you don't have to become a pescatarian. You don't have to have a fish every single meal, which I did, by the way, for a year. I ate fish for an entire year. Didn't quite work. but I think fish a couple of times a week and then mostly vegetables the rest of the other time, leads you to a diet that's very low carbon impact, very low water use impact, very low impact on open space, and leads to generally, dietary studies are always tricky, but when you look at the sort of overall questions around mortality, there were a couple of ecologists that did a kind of meta-analysis of what was the diet that was least environmentally harmful and most beneficial, and they kind of settled on this sort of pescatarian version, and, they did see, again, with diets, you never can know exactly what's causing the effect. Is it exercise? Is it that people who would lean naturally in this direction anyway were already pretty healthy? But, there is, I would say, good evidence that leaning towards the pescatarian diet would be good for you and would be good for the planet.
It sounds like what your billion-dollar idea needs to be is a way to make anchovies a little bit more palatable to a wider market. If you can figure that one out, I think you've got your idea.
I don't know. I went on, I did a frontline a year ago where I ate fish for a year, for every meal for a year. And we went to Peru, and the owner of the Peruvian anchovy factory, there was one factory out of all these other factories that reduced anchovies. There was one factory that actually canned them for human production or human consumption. And he gave me a 20-pound can of anchovies.
Wow. That's a big can.
It was quite a can. Certainly, I got some looks from TSA when I tried to bring that through and put on the plane. I think that we are sometimes a little too fixed in our attitudes about what is a good food and what isn't. I mean, if you go to the Amalfi Coast, where I did some of my research, there's one restaurant I went to, and I went to this town called Chitara, which is sort of famous for anchovies in the way that, say, Parmigiano is famous for its cheese. So there, everything on the menu was an anchovy of one kind or another, and I found it delicious. And a lot of it also, I think, is about getting children to try these interesting new tastes at an early age. I think we're too permissive of our children to kind of just eat bland food all the time. So my billion-dollar idea might be 50 years in the making, but I do think that it's worth considering and worth not being so inflexible as Americans typically are around food.
Give us some concrete recommendations here. What kind of fish are like your favorites that you love to buy, don't feel guilty eating about because they're actually sustainable?
I have my regulars, and I would say that the regular fish that I eat are Alaskan sockeye salmon, because I've observed the fishery and I think it's well managed. It's also important to support the fishermen who are catching sockeye right now, because there's a huge copper and gold mine that a Canadian company is trying to put on top of the largest sockeye salmon run left in the world. So I would like to support the fishermen in that case. So I always have Alaska sockeye. I'll always have anchovies, as I say. Mussels are a big crowd pleaser in my house. Clams and oysters very, very often. I do a fair amount of fishing myself, and I do kind of keep an eye on what is in good shape stock-wise.
And on the flip side, is there a fish that you don't eat anymore because of your research on this topic?
The one blanket thing that I personally stay away from, after my year of eating seafood for a year, I ended up having with quite high mercury levels. And I started to really look at the kinds of fish that I was eating. And Consumer Reports found that tuna, canned tuna in particular, is the largest source of methylmercury in the American diet. There are so many issues around tuna. Certainly, you know, there are well-managed stocks, but there's also overexploited stocks. We've had tuna interrelated with slavery issues that the AP, you know, has done such a great job reporting on. You know, it's like all that together, the mercury, the slavery, the imports, makes me, generally speaking, I tend to stay away from tuna. Before I started writing about fish, I ate much more tuna than I do now. And now I don't really eat it unless I'm in a situation where it's sort of put in front of me.
Paul Greenberg is author of The Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. He'll be giving a public talk at the New England Aquarium this Thursday at 7. Paul, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Up next, engaging communities to support underrepresented minorities in science. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.